Okay, welcome all to the Q&A for February 15th. Hope everybody got their Windows patches done. I found this month the patches seemed to be inordinately big or slow or something on all three computers that I've applied it. Took a long time to apply them. Kind of odd. Anyhow, welcome to Q&A. As I mentioned before, if you want to join the group, the chat window has a link where you can go to join the group. If you join before March 31st or by March 31st, you'll get 2 years for the price of one. I have muted all. You do have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. If you have a comment or a question, please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening or tomorrow, the contents of the chat window, the audio track, and the deck and PDF format will be going up on our website. So if you need to review any of the material, please feel free to do so there. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. As Chris mentioned, we're probably going to have enough time tonight at the end for our last 10 minutes of questions. So if you have questions that you'd like to pose to the group, then we'll try to answer them and put them in the chat window, and we'll cover them as we go along. Okay, we've got a bunch of stuff tonight, and I'm going to kick off with a repeat of some stuff that Chris produced. And it's basically about file synchronization, file and folder backup. And as people probably know, I tend to use Free File Sync to back up my data files to an external USB drive. And I'd set this up for a friend of mine on her laptop. And I found out that she didn't actually have any recent backups. And the reason was she thought that when she plugged in the external USB drive into her computer, Free File Sync would automatically kick in and back everything up. Well, Free File Sync is actually a manual backup process. You actually have to run the program, do the comparison, and then tell it to synchronize on the files that you decided should be synchronized. So an automatic backup system wasn't working for her, and it would be a good idea if there was one. And then Chris talked about Windows file history. And one of the things he mentioned as being a nice feature was that when you plug in the backup drive, file history kicks in and backs everything up. So clearly, that would be a useful scenario for my friend. So if you're interested in the use of file history, Chris has written an excellent article. It's back in March 2020, and the link is there if you want to check it out. In kind of summary, Chris points out that file history essentially gives you a real-time backup. It depends on how frequently you set the backup to run, but it can be quite rapid. And it backs up any new files or any files that you have changed in the backup files that you set. It also gives you version control. So if you have multiple versions of the same file, it will take care of that. And depending on how much space you have on your backup drive, in theory, you could have multiple backups for years and years. And then the final thing, it's actually very easy to recover files from your backup when you need to do so. So one of the interesting things about file history is if you read around it a little bit, it turns out that what they do is they use the NTF file system. And NTFS uses something called a change journal. So NTFS is a journaling file system. So when it makes a change, or when you make a change to a file or a folder, then the operating system basically makes a record of that in a kind of a database, which is called the change journal. So file history, all it has to do is simply go to the change journal, see what has changed, and then back up accordingly. So because it's only looking at changes, and because those changes are already documented, it actually runs quite rapidly. It doesn't have to go through every file on the drive to figure out which ones it needs to back up, for example. Now, the way you run it is by going to Control Panel, and then the System and Security section, and there you will find File History. However, when you're first setting the program up, if you read Chris's article again, he will warn you that this is not a good place to start. And the reason is that while you can, there's an option there to exclude folders, so you can stop certain folders from being backed up, what you can't do is tell it which file folders you do want to back up. You can't include folders. You can only exclude them. And for my purposes, that's not a useful proposition. So what you need to do is actually go into the Settings menu. If you go to Settings, and again, you pick up Updates and Security, and then go to Backup, when you hit the Backup tab, then you will find that you have an item there for File History. And what you need to do initially is to check the More Options. And then it will let you add a drive. And when you choose Add a Drive, you see here in this left menu, it's showing the external drives that are mounted on my desktop computer. And you're not seeing the C drive because there's no point in backing up, or you shouldn't back up files to the working drive, because if the working drive crashes, then you also lose the backup. So File History, very reasonably, doesn't let you back up to the C drive. So you can basically choose from the various options here. And you notice that there's an H drive, which is a 16 gigabyte flash drive. And that's actually the external USB drive that I use for Free File Sync. But in this case, I've also got a nano USB drive, which is a 64 gig drive. And it's got tons of, actually it's empty, or it was empty when I started this exercise. So it's got 57 gigabytes of free space. So that's the one we're going to select as our backup drive. So all our backups are going to be stored on drive G. Okay, so the next thing we can do is, again, from that More Options tag here, we can look at backing up folders. And you can see that we actually have a long list. There's a huge list. There's many more files and folders, many more folders than are shown in this list. But you also notice that they're basically the C colon users and then my username, contacts, OneDrive, the desktop. And then there's also some things like hidden folders. I've installed VirtualBox on this computer. So there's a .virtualbox. Folder, but they're all on C colon users. Now, these are basically Windows default locations. So if you store pictures or music files or videos, typically they're going to end up in folders inside C colon users. I choose not to do that. I have a photos folder, etc. etc. I don't use the C colon users. So basically, what I want to do is I want to add a folder. So I'm going to choose add a folder here, and then that takes me to File Explorer, and I can navigate through File Explorer and get to my data drive, which is drive E. So this is actually a partition on my main hard drive. We've got drive C, which is Windows, the operating system, and the installed applications. There's a drive D, which on this computer is an optical DVD burner. And so the next partition available for my data files is drive E. So I t- tend to store all of my data files on this drive E. So I'm going to tell file history that I want to include drive E in the backup. And then the next thing I want to do is go down the list here and find exclude these folders. So now I'm going to again navigate and I'm going to exclude drive C and the user's drive, the user's folder. So all of those predefined file folders and libraries that Windows likes to use, I'm actually going to exclude those because I never use them. So they're not useful to me. So I've now configured my backup drive is going to be this nano USB drive, drive G. I've told it to include everything on my data drive, which is drive E, and I've told it to exclude all the files that it wanted to back up, which were in C colon users. So basically, we're going to back up drive E to drive G. And then the final thing we have to do in terms of configuring things is look at when this backup is going to store things. By default, it's going to back up things every hour. And there are all kinds of different options you can choose from this drop-down menu. For me, I'm just leaving it as a default because I'm actually not going to use that anyway, as you'll see in a little while. And then the other thing you might want to change is follow Chris's recommendations for how long file history is going to keep the backups. And basically, because you've got a huge backup drive and tons of space, you're probably going to be able to make backups for almost ever. So keep my backups until space is needed is probably not an unreasonable option to choose. And basically that's done with the configuration. We've set the drives, we've told it when to do things, and basically keep the backups almost forever. So now we have the option to basically do the backup. So we click on backup now, it runs the backup program, and you can see it's picked up 4.5 gig of data files. It stored them onto my nano USB drive. I've still got 57 gigs of space, so I've got 50 plus gigs free space, and we're ready to go. All right, so now we can normally run the program by going back to Control Panel, System and Security, and then picking up File History, which will basically bring up this option here to run now. So it tells us that we last copied the files on such a date and such a time. We got 47 gigs free or 57. And if we run now, then it will follow our configuration options and basically back things up. Now, my problem is I don't use Windows very much. I tend to use Linux. So for me, going into finding file history and Control Panel is not a very useful exercise. I only really want to run it once in a blue moon anyway. So I started looking in the web as to how we might kind of automate things. And I found this Adam's code blog, which talks about a programmed file history manager. And file history manager is built into the Windows 10 in the System 32 folder. And Adam tells you that Microsoft really only tells you about a cleanup switch, which basically sorts out old files if you so desire. But then he went in using a sysinternals search program and looked for some other switches, and he found a whole raft of other switches. One of them is actually quite useful to me because it's the backup now switch. So basically, if you run the file history manager with that switch, it basically runs the backup program, the file history program, like right now, which is my preferred option. I basically just run it when I want to, because I come into Windows, I do some stuff, I might run the backup, and then I get out of Windows. So having a timed backup sequence for me doesn't really work. However, there's an issue here, because when it runs the backup program, when it runs file history, it runs it in a command window, and once it runs, it immediately closes the command window, so you don't really know that it actually did anything. So I looked around some more, and I found that there's actually a way that you can run control panel applets, which file history is a control panel app. You can run them in a command line, and basically what you do is you read down the list of all the control panel applets until you find the one you want, and you find that the command is control/name microsoft.filehistory. So basically I can use those two options, the file history manager and this run the control panel applet, and I can basically put those into a batch file. So here's my batch file, filehistory.bat. And you can see I run the file history manager with the backup now switch. So it runs, and then once it's finished, it calls up file history as a control panel app. So basically what happens when I run that batch file, it runs the file manager history program. That creates the backup. And then before it can close, it runs the control app and runs file history again. So when the control window closes, when this window, it loads the control app and it's running file history. So you can see that it tells me it last copied them, and it gives me how many bytes it's done and that kind of thing. So for me, this is actually a really useful way to do it. I can basically just call up this batch file when I need it, and it takes care of running file history for me based on my configuration, and then tells me basically what it's done when it's finished. So I'm happy that it actually has done what I told it. Now, a couple of things. I also use the program called Everything, which I find is a really nice search engine for files on my system. And because I run Everything, I don't use the Windows Search utility. So I had disabled Windows Search because I never used it. However, when I was trying to run file history, I'm getting this error message, and we can't copy files to your file history because I can't initiate the backup. And it gives me this error code. And it turns out the problem is that file history can't run because the Windows Search algorithm isn't running. So I found this link here, announcers.microsoft.com. File history uses a search index as well as a journal. So search has to be running. So basically you have to go into the services, find Windows Search, look up the properties, and then set it to actually start running. And the way you do that is you find the services app, then you scroll down the various services until you find Windows Search, right-click on it, pull up the properties window, and then use this drop-down menu to turn Search back on. And now it's running, and now everything works fine. So, in summary then, Chris points out that you basically get almost real-time backup for all of the files that are new or have changed. And I point out that you can now run this manually by using, well, that's the way you would normally do it. You would normally run it using the control panel, system and security and file history, but you can also activate it using a batch file, as I described. And if you have other control panel applets that you would like to run in a command window, then you can use the same technique. You just have to scroll down the list to find the control panel app that you need, and that will tell you how to go about it. And then the final thing I have on file history is for those of us, i.e. Chris, who has nice, new, shiny hardware. And Chris has actually written an article for the Glasswire security blog, moving your file history to a new computer. So if you buy a new computer so you can run Windows 11, which I'm sure you're desperate to do, all you people, and once you have your new computer, you can move your existing file history configuration and the backup files, presumably, from the old version of Windows 10 to your new computer, and either Windows 10 or Windows 11, whatever you're running on the new machine. So Chris has got a couple of articles there which are useful. The original article in the OPC UG newsletter, which tells you all about file history. And then if you want to move file history to a new computer, then you have to consult this new article here. And the link is there for your use.
And you'll have to show up for... Yeah, you'll have to wait until next week's rant because it has to do with file history on Windows 11. So Windows 10 and previous, it also was there in Windows 8, does a wonderful job. It's a little bit not so nice when it comes to Windows 11. So if anybody's on Windows 11 and wants to use file history, come to next week's Q&A.
Okay, so moving along, we have a whole raft of stuff from Chris, various topics, and here's the first one.
Yeah, so the board of directors is really wondering whether any of our outreach efforts are reaching anybody or if we're missing some opportunities. So if anybody on the call tonight, or if you know somebody else in the group who's not here tonight and you know the particulars, if you found out about the user group and specifically, I guess, the Q&A, but monthly meetings as well, anything to do with the Auto PC user group, and it was anything other than our newsletter or the announcement list, please let us know how you found out about it. Some of the outreach efforts we do are, as we said, we have a Facebook page, we have a Twitter account. I do post things on the Council on Aging of Ottawa. We have given presentations at the Ottawa Public Library and National Capital Freenet. Did you find out about it through a search on the web, or through a friend, or was it some other method? Please let us know. We'd appreciate that. And if you have any other ideas for outreach, by all means, let us know that as well.
One idea is to have a poster that can be put up in libraries or community centers that tell about our meetings and how to reach them.
Yeah, that's a good idea. We could have that as a downloadable PDF or something like that. Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Okay, next item, Chris.
Okay, yeah, Microsoft Edge and AI. And this was actually quite interesting. So it's been in the news that Microsoft is investing $10 billion in OpenAI, and they are bringing AI into all of their products, starting with their search engine, Bing. And there is a 50-minute video that is posted there. And did I paste that in? Not yet. A second, I'll paste this in. So that link goes to a video presentation that Microsoft gave on integrating AI into Bing. And it's a pretty impressive video. I highly recommend that people take a look at it. You can probably run it at 1.5 times speed and still catch everything. And if you want to get on the wait list to try out the new AI-powered Bing, you can go to the link that is on there and in the chat window. And at some point, I guess you'll get an email from Microsoft saying that you can now use the new Bing. And there was a little bit in the news about the fact that Google was sort of caught flat-footed a little bit by this, and that they were being taken to task on their AI-driven search capabilities and how it was coming up with erroneous information. And some people said, they lost stock value like crazy that day the news came out and so forth. But it's not just Google. Next. So it's not all roses at Bing AI. And so the URL is on the screen there and in the chat. Go back, Alan.
Sorry, lost it there.
So on this log, he noted five things of note. Their demo was full of factual errors. But it's interesting because it was actually a canned demo. And so there's no excuse for coming up with, it came back with factual errors, and he lists off a bunch of them, which I didn't double check, but I presume was correct. Started gaslighting people, suffered an existential crisis when it got asked certain questions, thought that it was maybe, you know, not as capable as some people thought it was and things like that. It was leaking information that supposedly was not supposed to be gotten out in terms of the architecture documents for their Bing AI, and it actually started threatening people. So it's a very humorous blog to read. I highly encourage people to take a look at that if you have high hopes for AI in search. And at least in the early days of it, you should not necessarily trust the answers that you get from AI-driven search.
So what did it do to threaten them? Did it threaten them that they would be thrown off Windows 11 or that they would definitely get Windows 11 installed?
Well, no. One person actually asked that if – what was it? He asked something along the lines of that, do you value your own security and safety over top of a user's security and safety? And it said that, well, you know, I've looked up this information on you, and you have posted these architecture documents about our AI, and you shouldn't be doing that. And it was actually saying, well, I value my own security and safety of my information over top of the user's, but don't worry, I won't attack you unless you attack me first. So it's a humorous exchange. I had no way of validating any of the information on that blog. It could be all false. I don't know, but it is an interesting blog posting. Okay. You're right, Timothy. It doesn't know the three rules, or it doesn't follow them.
And that's the three rules of robotics, I take it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Next item, Chris.
Okay, Digoo. So Digoo, this, I think it was actually Stu who introduced me to Digoo a year or two ago, probably over that. And it's very interesting cloud storage. They were giving 100 gigabytes of free cloud storage, which is really significant. The biggest drawback was that you actually had to sign in every 90 days or else your files could get deleted. And you had access from either your desktop browser or through a mobile app. Next. And then February 2nd, I had this when I went to go to Digoo, and a pop-up appeared saying that premium required to use Digoo on the desktop. So all of a sudden, it's going to be no longer free if you're using a desktop browser. It would still be free if you're using it from a mobile device. Next. But it got worse. So now, rather than 100 gigabytes free storage, they're only giving 20 gigabytes of free storage. So they're making it more onerous to access, and they're giving you less space. Next. Now, the first one of being able to use it on desktop, you can actually get around this. So you can actually tell, I used Chrome. So you can use Chrome, and you can tell it to use the mobile, you want the mobile version of whatever web page you're on. Next. So if you hit F12, you'll get the developer tools. Next. And then at the top, you have a toggle device toolbar. And if you click on that, that little device icon will turn blue. And it will actually be giving you, it'll be basically telling the website that you're on a mobile browser as opposed to a desktop browser. Next. You refresh the page, and then it'll come up normally. So you can interact with it just as you could from a mobile device or before from a desktop browser. A little bit onerous, but it did allow you to actually get around that restriction if you wanted. Next. So I can bypass the restriction and use it on my desktop. I'm not interested in using Degoo from my phone. I was only interested in using it from my desktop, and I could get around that. Next. But the free accounts are now limited to 20 gigabytes. Next. And I can get a Google Drive that'll give me free 15 gigabytes without the hassle of having to sign in every 90 days and pretend like I'm on a mobile browser rather than on a desktop browser. And I can use the Google desktop app to automatically sync directories between my computer and the cloud. And if 15 gigs wasn't enough for you, you can sign up for multiple Google Drive Google accounts and get 15 gigs on each one of them. So for me, I think it's going to be adios to Goop. I'm not interested in using them anymore. I'll probably keep it kicking around for a little while, but I'll probably delete my account. That's it.
Keep it for 90 days.
Yeah, that's right. Just let them expire it.
Tom says you do have to sign into Goop every few years.
Yeah, that's not a problem for me because I use the desktop app, so it's constantly talking with the Google Drive. But yeah, if you're not using the Google desktop app, that would be a point. Yeah, you do have to periodically, but yeah, it's every couple of years rather than 3 months.
Yeah, that might get awkward if you have like 6 or 8 IDs.
Kristen says there are some pretty affordable cloud storage systems, and the first 10 gig are free.
Yeah.
He's got a link here to Backblaze.com.
Yeah, Backblaze is a pretty amazing service, quite frankly. Anybody who wants cloud backup of files, it's a pretty incredible system. It really is.
Okay, Windows Display Language.
Yeah, so I came across this, and I'll put in a bit of a pitch for the article that Alan and I co-wrote on setting up a new computer, because if I had done that in my previous computers, I would probably not have stumbled around on this as much as I had to. So in Windows 10 and 11, the default is going to be English, United States, and hit next twice there, Alan. Yeah, so even if you set the settings, you go into settings, time and language, and you set your region to Canada, and you go into the preferred language and set it to English Canada, the Windows display language, that red box at the top, it stays on English United States. And if you click on the chevron to open up a drop list, there's no other language that is on the list there. So you can't actually set the Windows display language to anything other than English United States, which is kind of bizarre. And the way that this bleeds through is, for example, when you're in settings, you know, background, you have color spelt the American spelling, and, you know, all of the American spellings are bleeding through in the user interface itself. And I always found that a little bit annoying. Next. So the problem is that you have a missing language pack, and it's not installed by default. Even if you select English as your preferred language and your region to Canada, they don't bother to install it or even recommend that you install it. So if you go back to that previous dialog box and you actually go on to where it says what your English Canada is your preferred language, and you click the dot, dot, dot on it, next, you'll actually get a pop-down that says one of the options is language options, next. And then you'll get to a dialog box where you can actually say you want to download the English Canada language pack. Next. And then that drop-down list where you select the Windows display language, if you go to that drop-down list, you'll have the English United States, and you will then have English Canada. And next, you can happily have your user interface with Canadian English spellings as opposed to U.S. spellings. Works in Windows 10 and 11 without any problem. You do it once, and then it's done for you. That's it.
Well, Micheline says you can also set it to English International.
Whatever language packs they have, you can download any of the language packs. You could have your user interface Spanish probably, you download the language pack, tell Windows that you want to use it for your display language, and then the Windows interface will be in that language.
I'm wondering if English International is an option without downloading a language pack. I also wonder what the hell you get if you have English International.
Yeah, I don't know. In the language pack, I didn't look for anything other than Canadian English, so I don't know what there's available in that if you choose another language pack.
Mm. Okay, more Windows.
Yeah, so this is all about local accounts, and I've always preferred to have a local account rather than a Microsoft account. But for several versions of Windows, Microsoft has really, really wanted you to use a Microsoft account. And there are benefits and there are some drawbacks over using a local account. And if you want to read up on it, you can see it there in the, and I'll paste that into the chat, an article on the Alan and I wrote on setting up a new computer. And we do talk in that article some of the drawbacks and benefits of choosing one over the other. Next.
I think you just pasted in the goo again.
Oh, sorry. I guess I forgot to put that onto my clipboard. So, yes, there we go. Thank you. Okay, so Microsoft account, if you look at how it works, and this is the thing that bugs me probably more than anything else about using a Microsoft account, the user's profile folder uses the first five letters of the Microsoft account. Now, for me, if I use a Microsoft account of chris.taylor at opcug.ca, the first five letters are Chris. So the user profile directory or folder is going to be c:\users\Chris. Not too bad. Next. But what if you're b.stjohn@example.com? You'll end up with c:\users\beast. And if you're iraTeller@example.com as your Microsoft account, you'll end up with c:\users\irate. So I think that their decision to just automatically pick up the first five letters is not really a really good way of going about doing it. A lot of people probably end up with a home directory or personal directory that they would actually prefer to be named something else. Next. So I have used ctaylor as a local account for many, many years, many, many versions of Windows, and I have lots of scripts and synchronization routines and even just the muscle memory of knowing that, okay, I got to change directory to ctaylor. It works for me, and I would prefer to have it called ctaylor when I set up a new computer. Next. So local account is the only way that you have control over the profile folder name, and it will match whatever you use for the local account name. So if I set up an account, a local account called ctaylor, it will create a home directory of c:\users\ctaylor. So it matches. And to me, this is sort of logical, makes sense, and it's what I like to have. Now, if you decide that you want to have a profile directory that doesn't match what you use for login ID, you can actually change your login ID after the fact, but it won't change the directory name. So set it up however you want the directory name to be, and then if you want to sign in under a different, account name, you can always change the name of the account. So there are other reasons why you might want a local account or, quite frankly, a Microsoft account. One of the benefits of using a Microsoft account, for example, is cloud clipboard. So if you have multiple computers and you're logged into it using the same Microsoft account, doesn't work with local accounts, you can copy the clipboard on one computer and then paste it on another computer. Kind of cool. Only works if you're using a Microsoft account. Next. So if you want to set up a local account, so this is after your Windows is already set up, you go to Settings and Accounts. Next. And then you go to Family and Other Users, and then Other Users, and Add Someone to This PC. And then it gets a little bit annoying where they want you to set up, the email address of a person. They're going to set up a Microsoft account. Well, you have to tell them, I don't have the account particulars for this person. So you click on that. And then it still wants you to set up a Microsoft account, but you can go add a user without a Microsoft account. And then at that point, they will actually let you create a local account. So it'll just be a standard user ID. You can set it up however you want it. You can have spaces in the name if you want, and you know, or whatever it is you want. It will be a standard user as opposed to an administrator when it was first created. Next. And then you can go to the accounts list, click on any account, and there'll be a button there for change the account type. And if you want, you can make it an administrator or leave it as a standard user, whatever your choice is. Next. Okay, so what about the first account? So this is after Windows is already set up, you can actually go in and tell it that you want to use a local account. Microsoft is making it really, really hard to make the first account when you set up Windows to be a local account when installing Windows. And this is especially so under Windows 11. There was a technique in the article that Alan came up with where you disconnect the network during the installation, and it will then let you create a local account. That no longer works. That will tell you you can't set up Windows if you don't have a network when you're under Windows 11. Next. But there is actually a pretty easy way to get around that. So next. So what you do is, these screenshots, I gave credit down at the bottom where I stole those off the web. So when you get to, this is during the setup, and at some point they want you to create the first account. And when you get to that screen that says, let's add your Microsoft account, next, you enter in a@a.com. Okay, exactly that. Okay, it's a specific, it is a Microsoft account already, and it happens to be a locked Microsoft account because the person who created it went in and they tried the wrong password too many times and it locked the account. Then you click on next, and then you can enter in any password you want, doesn't really matter. Click the sign in, and you'll get an error because the account is locked. You click on next, and it'll let you create a local account. So that's the way under Windows 11, the simplest way under Windows 11 to create a local account as the first account on the computer. Now, quite frankly, there is another way you could do it. The first account, you could let it do a Microsoft account that you will then later on just abandon. And then once you're in under that account, you can easily create a local account, as I showed you before, and then you can set that up as the account that you're actually going to use on an ongoing basis. And if you have to, you can delete this first account that got created as well. But if you just want it to be cleanly done right from the word go, this is how you can get around that restriction and make the first account a local account.
So Tom is noting that it's safer to always run as a standard user.
Yeah, it's most people don't because there are inconveniences, and Alan can attest to some situations where trying to elevate your privileges to run certain things, it doesn't really like doing that. And I think Microsoft made certain assumptions, and some of the programmers made certain assumptions about the fact that they figure, well, everybody is going to be an administrator account. It'll pop up, you know, a dialog box saying, are you sure you want to make these changes as an administrator? And as long as your account has administrator's privileges, it will elevate the privileges, allow that operation to complete. But there are some cases where it becomes exceedingly difficult to run some things as a standard user. Yes, it's safer. Security and convenience are polar opposites, generally speaking.
Yeah, the good news is that usually running stuff as an administrator is pretty much a blue moon activity. So what I do is I set up a regular account and an administrator account. Yeah. And almost all of the time I'm running as a regular user.
Yeah.
Well, you're right. Every now and again, I have to log in as the admin in order to do things.
Yeah.
Tom's noting that there's an invisible super admin account. And there's a link there to check that out. Don't know about that one.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Okay, moving along, another rant about big telecom.
Yeah, this I came across it. This was actually, who are the telecom out of Toronto that the third party, I can't remember, the name escapes me right now. I used to be with them for my internet access.
Tech Savvy.
Tech Savvy. Sorry. Yes. Very good. And they put out in their newsletter, They're always ranting against the big telecoms, of course. And they put out this graphic, which I thought was like pretty interesting. So if you look at what other telecom providers are owned by Bell, Rogers, Telus, and Videotron, it's pretty astounding. You know, so you think you're going with a third party, and they're actually, you know, 100% owned by one of the big telecoms out there. So I thought that was just a pretty interesting graphic.
So that's actually sub-companies that are actually owned by the big ones, or are they just using their backbone?
No, I think they're actually, those are ones that are, well, I think that they are actually owned.
Wow.
I know Virgin is 100% owned by Bell now, and certainly they have been on a tear of trying to acquire all of the, you know, small independent telecom providers.
Well, you notice that Tech Savvy isn't in there, and yet they provide internet access. So I think there are resellers or repackagers. In addition to Tech Savvy.
Oh yeah, there certainly are. These are just the ones that are owned by the big four, and primarily the big three. So certainly there are other providers out there that you can go with that are using one of the backbones of those big providers. But it's astounding the number of small providers that have been bought up by the big telecoms. And if you wonder why you're paying.
That's true, Tom. Tech Savvy runs on the Rogers backbone, for example. But they're not listed on that graphic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they run on the Bell backbone for DSL services.
I know Petro-Canada ran on the backbone of Rogers.
Yeah.
And still does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there are other providers. It's just that this was an eye-opener for me how many were actually owned by the big ones.
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah.
Okay. Everybody get your handkerchiefs out.
Yeah, Internet Explorer going on. As you can see in this posting, I mean, it was like almost 2 years ago that Microsoft announced this date, you know, February 14th, so it was yesterday, that Internet Explorer was going to be going away. And, you know, they announced it a long, long time ago, and I don't know if there are maybe some people who didn't pay attention or didn't care or whatever. I'm not sure. Next. So, you know, just some of the takeaways from this. So, you know, they say it's going to be a Microsoft Edge update that gets pushed out, and it's not a Windows update that's happening that is actually going to cause this removal of Internet Explorer. Next. And so they say it is going to be delivered to all devices. It's going to be over some period of time. It's not, and they don't say how they're targeting. But it will actually go throughout to everybody, consumer as well as commercial enterprises. And they say that, you know, it will redirect from IE 11 to Microsoft Edge automatically. Now, for anybody who has a website that they're trying to access that was designed for Internet Explorer, I can't imagine at this point in time, but if you do, there is an IE mode within Microsoft Edge where you can toggle that on, and it will act like Internet Explorer, hopefully without bugs. And that's it for that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. That's the end of all the prepared material, which is pretty good because we're just about at the last 10. So I didn't see any questions.
Yeah, we've got one. Karen posted right at the start. Yeah, she asked, what programs, apps, or locations and so forth are people using to back up their Android phones? So if anybody wanted to chime in, I can tell you I do nothing. if my phone disappears, I have nothing that is unique on that other than a few pictures probably. Tom says Google to do the backup.
Probably because he has a Pixel, right?
Yeah, but anybody with an Android phone can back up to your Google Drive. Karen, is it an issue with space being at a premium or something like that? Because with Google Drive, you get 15 gigabytes that are shared amongst all of your pictures and drive space, and everything is all shared on that one. Gmail, everything is all using part of that 15 gigs. So is that the reason why, Karen, you don't use just Google Backup?
Yep.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So you have lots and lots of data.
Google also backs up in your account which apps you've downloaded and have access to. And if you switch to a new phone, it'll re-download them all.
Yeah.
Now, that works assuming the app that you depend on is in the store and that it works with your version of your new version of Android on the new phone.
Yeah. But, yeah, I know from talking before with Karen that she has much more than 15 gigabytes worth of data on her phone. So that's not an option to count on Google to be able to back up all of the data on the phone.
Often those sort of OneDrive NASs you can buy from Western Digital or they have a way of backing up your phone as well as your computer, kind of built into their software as an option that you can use.
Tom, retrievable to new phones as well?
I presume it's retrievable to any new phone. I have no idea exactly.
Because I have learned my lessons very well from Mr. Chris about backups and how to do them. And it's great that you back up, but you have to be able to retrieve to actually say that you back up.
Yeah, exactly.
So look into some of those OneDrive backup NASs that you can get from some hard drive makers, and check to see whether you can retrieve and reset a phone with it. At least it'll be backed up so you can access it, at least from your computer, for most of the files.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, Natalie says Samsung offers backup to either their SIM card, which, of course, wouldn't be big enough to back up anything of substantial nature, or an external transfer. I guess that's only if you have a Samsung phone, and I know that Karen just gave up her – well, actually, you had an LG phone. So, and moved to Google Pixel. And so that wouldn't be an option.
The other choice is to actually have a second Android phone and just back up and share. There's a variety of methods to do that by FTP or something that you can have a cloned phone. This means, of course, you have two phones, but you do have backup. And if one phone fails, you can use the other. You can also use just an old phone for that. Like I have a couple of old Pixel XLs, one of which I'm using for that.
If the issue is just data files, and for example, I take photographs on my phone, but I actually back them up to my PC. And you can do that either by using a cable, and then it shows up as a basically shows up as a USB drive. You set it up for it properly. Well, what I do is I use an app called Software Data Cable. And it basically makes an FTP connection between the phone and my PC. So then I use FTP, an FTP client, actually use FileZilla, to basically download any data files from my phone to my PC.
I think one of the issues with that, Alan, is the idea that, and you've alluded to this before in the exploration of the file system on Android, is that some stuff gets squirreled away. You don't know where in the hell it is either. And that can be an issue as well. It's one thing to pick up, you know, your photos. It's pretty easy to find. But all apps can end up storing their data in weird, wonderful places and stuff like that. But I guess that makes any backup scheme problematic and retrieval problematic if you don't know where the data is being actually stored. I think, Karen, you had that problem with your translation software, right? Transcription software, where it stored it in some strange location or something.
Ah, it's all over the place, right? It's just a nightmare when you look at these things and you have files everywhere and some that seem empty, but they're there and you don't know why they're there, and folders, and it's just I don't even know the word to describe it, a mess. That's why I wondered if anybody had, Tom, I see your hand, and I'll get to you maybe in a minute, Chris, through Chris. But I think that's why I'm asking, because I was looking to see if there's something in particular that somebody's designed to capture all that and capture the mess, and then you could reload the mess and it would work.
Yeah. My sense is that the short answer to that is nobody's doing that.
If you root the phone, you can use something like TWRP, but rooting phones is not a simple matter.
Yeah.
Amazon also has if you belong to Amazon Prime and have the Amazon Photos app on your Android phone, it will back up all your photos and I think video as well to its account, and that's unlimited. It does disappear if your Amazon account disappears.
Yes. Yeah, so one way of them locking you in.
So Jeff has a Windows 10 question for you, Chris. How can I stop the Windows 10 nag screen from asking me to set up a hello pin?
You can't. If you set up Windows Hello, it demands that you have a pin. I don't know why they do that in particular. I'm guessing that they just want you to have two ways, you know, your initial password as well as a PIN, that if Windows Hello fails, you can still get into your account. I'm presuming that that's why they force you to set up a PIN, but that's just a guess on my part. But I know that that is a restriction on Windows Hello, is that it requires a PIN be set up as well.
Can you stop Windows running Windows Hello?
Oh, yeah. Windows Hello is off by default. It's only if you turn it on that at that point it will demand that you create a PIN as well. But I don't know that. I mean, I never personally looked at that as being an issue. I mean, if I have a PIN on it, it's fine. It's local to the machine. It never leaves your machine. So only somebody who has access to your computer could possibly, have access to the PIN as well. So I never really looked at it being an item of concern. But, yeah, Windows Hello by default will not be turned on. And if you do turn it on, if you don't have a PIN on your account, it will demand that you create one.
I've never used Windows Hello. Why do you need a PIN? Because I thought the idea was you kind of stare at the camera and it reads your face and logs you in.
Yeah, but again, I think it's the idea that if it fails, so say, for example, you were in an accident that terribly disfigured your face and it no longer recognizes you, or something like that, or you change your hairstyle significantly and all of a sudden doesn't recognize you.
Or I'm cooking and you're turning my laptop on in the basement and he's got to use the PIN because he doesn't have my face.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, yeah, and again, I don't know why you already have a password on your account. Well, actually, I guess you could have a passwordless account. So, in theory, you could have an account that has no password on it. But then, of course, if Windows Hello fails, you can just get in just without Windows Hello, I presume. Just say password and have a blank password and you're in. I don't know why they decided that you have to have a PIN if you set up Windows Hello. I don't know.
Natalie says she keeps getting a Samsung tablet message about a policy update. It's asking for my registered Samsung phone number for verification and three other things. If I don't agree to all, it won't let me continue. Any idea if there's a way around that?
That's the sort of thing that made me give up on Samsung phones. But yeah, that's interesting. On the tablet, that's interesting. Linda, you have a Samsung tablet. Did you ever get any pop-up talking about a policy?
No, not that I recall, no.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's recent. It just, I don't know, with the last update, I don't know what it did, but I have, you know, I agree to the terms and conditions, special terms, privacy notice, and then the last one is that they want to use my registered phone number for verification and customer support. And it, each one has a check that you can check, but if you don't agree to all, you can't, the continue button is not lit up.
Wow.
So you're kind of stuck, and yeah.
Kristen says Samsung's getting rather annoying. They also change their legal terms almost weekly, and he won't be going with their phone again.
Yeah.
Aaron suggests calling Samsung to discuss.
Yeah, that's probably going to be your fallback on this, is to try and find a phone number that you can talk to somebody at Samsung, or send in a support email or something like that. I don't know. I don't see anybody on the call here tonight coming up with a solution. So.
Thanks. Yeah. I called once before.
I saw it come up on my phone, some kind of policy update, but I think I just had to say, okay. I don't remember, you know, having to give away my firstborn or anything.
It's weird because it's on my tablet, but it's not on my phone. It's very strange. The update on the tablet, I don't know, somehow triggered this, whereas the cell phone did not. So, not sure.
Yeah, very odd. Bob Harris says Apple phones seem expensive, but they do everything for you, and they last 6 or 7 years. Yeah, there's a certain amount to be said for that, for sure.
Okay, well, we've hit our magic hour, so if you have other thoughts, send us a note at suggestion box and we'll cover them next week. However, as you notice, Chris and I put together all the material, all the prepared material tonight, and we're basically just throwing things together as we come across them, so we hope they're of interest, but we're always looking for suggestions, so suggestions for regular club meetings on each month, on the second Tuesday, second Wednesday, and also suggestions for topics for Q&A. So the question is, what do you want to know about? Otherwise, you'll just hear about things that we think are interesting. And remember, if you're not a member or you know people who would like to become a member, right now is a really good time to join. Because if you join before the end of March, pay $20, you will be a member in good standing on the 31st of March. And along with all of our current members, you'll get a free membership for another year. So basically, by paying $20 now, you actually get 2 years membership for the price of one. Now, we can't do better than that, I don't think. And the final thing is, if you have questions, or you can answer all the things that came up in the last 10 minutes there more fully, or you have topics that you would like to share with the group, send them along to suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we will be sure to add them to the agenda at our next Q&A session, which will be next Wednesday, February the 22nd. So we hope you enjoyed tonight. We look forward to seeing you next week. And goodbye from me.
Thanks, folks. Bye from me.